Hi everyone, my name is João and I'm your host of the Software Crafts podcast. Today with us we have Andra Sonea, and for the past 20 years Andra found herself working with banking and insurance technology. It was not called fintech then, and it was not so cool as is today. During this time she built systems, maintained systems made by others, worked on so many cold transformations, advised startups and C-level executives of large banks on next steps and strategy. Left by herself, she likes to untangle complicated stuff. She spends her time between FinTech OS, a scale-up she joined this year, and her PhD in urban science at the University of Warwick. Hi, Andra, and thanks for your time.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
No problem. So, for today, we have a simple heuristic, and it is solve specific problem. Not general case. How is your approach to solve problems?
It depends on the context. Context it's important. In my usual job, dealing with systems, I go towards the specific, and I spend quite a lot of time on what others consider detail, only to resurface at some point with an abstraction or a more generic view that can be easily conveyed. And then I go back to detail if I really need to solve the problem. And I go back to the specific. I also spend a lot of time on the, let's say, general or abstract or theory, because I choose to spend part of my time in academia doing research, and I'm trying to find solutions to problems, and there you are required to be more abstract somehow, at least in my experience to date.
Okay, thanks. I see that you can, because you have two personas, let's say you bounce between two realities.
I have many.
Many personas. It will be fun. So one of the things that you talk about in the beginning is the context. The context matters, how you approach.
Yeah.
How do you determine the context that you are in?
Despite the probably the first impression, I'm a people person. I speak with people. So if, for example, I deal with a client, I go beyond that room where we initially discuss problems and so on, and I go and search for the people who are supposed to use the system that we are dealing with. Either they use that system, it's an existing system, or we want to build a system for them. And really, I speak with the users, you know. I learned a lot from them because I want to understand how they think. So for me, the problem when dealing with systems and problems could come from many angles. So on one side, I don't know, an executive who has a problem tells me his perspective or how the problem affects his business, his budget, or where he wants to go. But on the other side, he's never the user. and I get this perspective from talking with people, looking at how they work, getting them to show me their current systems. And sometimes I really spend 1 hour just watching somebody doing what they do. And I put together a picture, and that's a context for me.
Okay. So I see that you have this heuristic that I wrote down and will add to my own personal library, that is beyond the room where we have the meeting. I really like that. And because you have over two decades with the industry, are people accepting that IT folks go outside of that meeting to explore? Did this perception change?
Here I would go probably for the specific and not for the general. I cannot generalize it. The industry is too big and too diverse. The interaction between technologists and so-called business people in financial service industry, I think it has changed. Again, it's a problem of larger context. Nowadays, people use in their daily life more technology than for their personal use than 10 years ago. And this, I think, increased the understanding of certain concepts which before stayed with the technologist. This makes the conversation easier somehow. The ways of working have changed quite a lot, and people experiment with various ways of working. You see more often more diverse and mixed teams working together, while before it was like, now we are discussing what to do and then we throw it over the fence to those guys who will do it. So now this is not happening so much. Yeah.
Okay, so we see some changes in our industry. And talking about changes, let's talk a bit about software development, because you like to untangle complicated stuff. And your initial observation and practices around the heuristic, you talk about abstractions. Do you still see lots of abstractions in code that are not needed? Do we still have this scene as software developers?
I think it's it's more of a zoo than it was before, or this is my perception and probably not correct. So 10 years ago, you would stay in a certain language or type of software, and kind of everybody would have somehow an understanding what they are dealing with, or there was a common language or a way of doing things. But now, very often, I end up in discussions where I'm not sure that two people have the same understanding of what we're talking about. It's the border between, you know, hardware and software, and how you deliver these things together has changed so much that I think before starting a project, we should all go to school again. To define the terms and to figure out how to work, we work together.
So it's a very, very interesting point. I have the feeling, because I did formal education until my master's, that at least at college level, we are very focused on content like databases or programming languages or security. But we are not thought or exposed to working together as a team. And today, well, we do, our job is with so-called legacy code, some application that is doing money, that is definition of legacy, and working in a team, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I understand your back to school and relearn again. And also you had something related to this before, right? You talk about that you observe that teams today are more diverse. And I can assume, because you were talking about throwing the work over the fence, you mean that teams are diverse in terms of skills, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you think that diversity is a change enabler?
Could you repeat, please? If I think that the diversity is
Enabler for change.
Enabler for change? Oh, yes, it is. It is. And I'm not going for a definition here. I'm just going for the experience. So, or the more generic thing, diverse or different, different from in relationship to you, for example. It happens that, for example, I emigrated 3 times and I exposed myself to 3 different cultures. So first I went to Italy, then to Germany, then to the UK. And I worked in different environments. And every time I felt like I'm decomposed in little pieces, and some pieces I have to drop. And then, you know, this is change. This is fundamental change at the individual level. You know, being exposed to something very different from you forces you to change. If you look at the bigger scale, this experience of working with people with very different mental models and habits, and in any way different, changes the environment. And to give you one more example, when I at university, we were forced to work in a group where they've chosen each of us to be from a different continent and have a different profession. I wanted to die. It was so hard. It was so hard at the beginning, because if you want to work with an accountant from India, a venture capitalist from South America, an actor from UK, and so on, and I was an IT person from, you know, Romania, Germany, and so on, the mental models are so different that in order for each of us to produce a piece of work, you have to change. And given the context of our world nowadays, there are so many aspects of the human life, you know, which are hidden from the working environment. It's somehow sanitized. Everybody's, you know, the diversity could come in many forms. That's it. Yeah.
Okay. Very thanks. Thanks to share this personal experience, how we can work together with different backgrounds and mental models. And now we also touch one of those words, almost a buzzword, that are mental models. And if we think about a team that is diverse, a team that have different backgrounds, and have supposed different mental models how the system work, how can we help a team to align these mental models? What are your go-to-go tools?
My usual tool was drawing, and I think it's nothing uncommon about this, but I was also in a room with people, my colleagues, the client, and you would draw, and people would react. People react to drawing. People react to lines. People, you make something visible to them, and this is when they tell you, "Oh no, it's not so. It's something else." And the drawing, it's a continuous process. It's not like we create a drawing and this is what we do from now on.
Well, today we are at home. We are more constrained. How was this experience for you, moving from a room with lots of people, feedback in real time, to the experience that we have today, that we need to do everything online?
It was very tough, if I'm honest. It was very tough. It's like having to speak a different language. To convey the same thing just by talking or trying to write, or it's not so efficient. Also, of course, there are tools for collaboration. But it also depends if others are prepared to use them. You cannot enforce a collaboration tool on people or on client, on the client, if they don't want to use it. As friendly as it seemed to you, or as useful as it seemed to me, I had the experience where I couldn't do this. The client would not engage with collaboration tools. It was like, oh yeah, another system. I just don't want to deal with that. So that's tough. Yeah.
Okay. And something that you learn to balance that, or you are still in the process of learning and you don't have anything measurable to change, to share, sorry, about this change?
I would say try whatever you think that might help, but it's not like, oh, I tried this, it didn't work, so I stopped. I don't try anything anymore with this client. I hope they will understand me. Try whatever you think it works, but be mindful that depending on the culture or the business maturity of the business you're dealing with, it might work or not. So I come from an environment in London where I worked regularly with startups and in incubators, or I advised businesses which were starting. It was 1 year or 2 years ago, the question was, help me build a bank. Okay, what the bank is made of. So, but in this context, you use a lot of tools. People were used to that. There was no need to advocate for, okay, how we can better work together. But you might have to deliver a project for a business which is, you know, more no business as usual, and you come like a storm over them, like to this, to that, use this. It doesn't necessarily work. So you do have to watch them if possible and try to figure out where you can intervene, where, or let them speak. Actually, that was useful, you know, to change the pace from me saying, okay, this is what you should do, this is asking them. It's more like a teacher, where you figure out from what the people say if they understood or not. And this is, you intervene when you need to correct what they didn't understand. But it's more difficult.
It is, yeah. Indeed. I share the same experience, that is more difficult in an online environment. But I also reckon that today everyone is at the same level, right? This is not a company that wants to work in a remote setup. Everyone across the world is forced to be at home and working from home. So at least the baseline is the same.
It's the same. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So, but I see what you are saying. And during this part of the interview, you talk about resistance, right? You come, bring a tool, and people, oh, yet another tool, and I'm facing this resistance. And I will like to go into this resistance, because you classify yourself to be work on so many transformations. And I'm very curious, how do you handle resistance in the transformations that you did in the past?
You have to pick and choose what battles you want to fight. I was lucky that as an advisor, usually my role was to or an architect, but it happens that very often I advise. As an architect, I work in two ways. Either I work with a development team and we do something, or sometimes I have to deal with executive of various forms and shapes who want to move the business in a certain direction. They don't know how, and tell me how, you know, kind of. And that type, I'm addressing more that type of resistance, because dealing with team, the customer and so on, yeah, it's a daily thing, you find it. But basically, trying to influence such big decisions and convey elements which to you are important because you have seen before that if you do that, this happens, and people don't get it. This is where my fight usually is. You know, I'm trying to explain the implication of certain decisions which happen now over the business in the future. Either the cost, or that the project will not be delivered, or that you're limiting your options. Or things like that. I wouldn't even call it resistance from their part. It's just we are a different path in on a different levels in the understanding of where we are going, or yeah. Obviously, I have a different perspective. As an external consultant, just, you know, comparing the banks and saying, oh, this bank did that and this one did something else. Maybe you don't want to do that. It persistence from my part, I guess. I see it as persistent, not, you know, addressing necessarily resistance. It's just, I have some fixed ideas.
Yeah, I can imagine, given your success. So lots of persistence needs to be there under the hood to share a vision or a path. Yeah. And I was writing lots of stuff, so we have more talking points. You talk about one of the dangers when you are explaining to executives or senior management is not to limiting the options. So yeah. I'm very curious, how do you keep the options open until the moment that you try to close them? How is your process?
I didn't think about this. I don't have a simple answer. So
it's not a simple problem.
Yeah, let me try to bring some thoughts together in a coherent way. I know that I somehow go after more context than most people in a business or in a project, and I don't know why it is so, and why I cannot gain that kind of safety or safe ground until I know a lot about the business in the context, what other do, what this type of system does, how it's supposed to work, and so on. So identifying the options for me, it's part of that. So it's not something that I discover at some point. So at the beginning, options are in my mind. Many options are in my mind. And then as we take decisions, we always close some options, but that's normal. What I find difficult is to convey what those options mean. And for this, I use the usual thing. It's an architecture decision, and I frame it in a simple way, like a phrase that anybody could repeat, or it has a common meaning. I write the option down. I'm very formal about this, actually. I write the options down, option one, option two, option three. We write the decision down, and then why we rejected the other one. Sometimes when people see this clearly, this is when they react. If you tell them, oh, you know, this happened, no. But when you formulate it like that, I think it's more to their understanding, like a contract. You did this, say bye-bye to that. You know. Did I answer the question? Or?
Yes, I believe that you answer the question about how to tackle limiting options too earlier, right? Because every decision gets the options that we have in the future. And you share your method of showing the trade-offs of every decision.
Yeah.
I'm curious there. Do you think that we in IT speak the right language towards whatever is the so-called business?
Probably not. And it's not easy. So on my side, I think I've made, I don't know how many steps towards the business. I remember that at the beginning of my job in my life in the UK, I don't know, here, for whatever reasons, you couldn't touch a financial system if you're not a chartered accountant. And I said, okay, what this means? Oh, there are 14 exams. And I said, okay, I don't have a problem with the exams. I did 14 exams, which was silly, you know, just in order to to have them trust me when I talk about this stuff, and I deal with their systems, to be able to frame what I was seeing and what I was trying to achieve. But yeah, that's just one aspect, and we normally deliver systems. How many languages you can acquire? You can try all the time and clarify the terms with them. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? And try to be very open, actually. It's difficult. It's a difficult topic, actually.
It is. We don't solve trivial problems with software. I think that we pass beyond that point. We try to solve complicated and complex problems. That's why I was so curious about your experience with language. Yeah. And we are going towards the end, but we have a few more minutes. Mm-hmm. And we spoke in other occasions about your, as you call, unconventional approach to tech. Why do you classify your approach unconventional?
Honestly, I didn't classify it myself. I think others say that it is, my approach is unconventional. I was not aware that it's unconventional. I think I'm interested in problems which I see in a certain way, and I'm interested in big picture, and I'm interested in the way the industry functions, and I'm interested in the fact that we kind of stay in the same train of thinking. People move from one bank to another, and there's quite a monolithic way of thinking about the problem. So there's no fresh thought, challenging ways of doing things. So if this is unconventional, I have no idea. But I guess I have this luxury after 20 years in the industry to ask why.
Okay, thanks. And to close off, I would like to ask you if you can share some resources, books or podcasts or blog posts that the audience could follow in any topic that we discussed today, or even things that we didn't discuss.
Okay, so I do listen to podcasts of various forms and shapes. So I think podcasts like yours, where people from the industry come and tell their share with us how they think, I think they're really, really important. My favorite podcast out of all of them is 99% Invisible. Maybe because I relate to that. It's how interesting and important are invisible things and their stories behind that. In terms of reading, I do read a lot for my PhD, and I prefer to read papers from other domains which I find similar to banking, let's say. So they talk about large system, global systems, having an impact on other systems, man-made systems, and so on. So hence urban studies, infrastructure, transportation, mobility. And I'm trying to learn various data science models, especially network science, in order to be able to abstract and analyze the problems I'm talking about, which is banking architecture usually. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. I will make sure that these resources are on the description of this episode, so the audience could follow, and probably if they have questions, they can reach out to you in Twitter for more questions, because these are
okay.
Deep and complex problems. And with this, I want to thank for your kind words towards the podcast, and also once again, thank you for your time, your personal time to be here today with us.
Oh, thank you very much. You're very kind. Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter at S-Crafts Podcast. Visit our website, softwarecraftspodcast.com, or follow our page on LinkedIn, Software Crafts Podcast. See you next week.